Underwriting support for the Book Show podcast on WAMC.org comes from Northshire Bookstore, Manchester, Vermont, and Saratoga, New York. An independent bookstore offering books, author events, gifts for children and adults, and more. Northshire.com. And the College of St. Rose, Albany, New York, offering a master's degree in English with a concentration in literature studies and an MFA in creative writing. strose.edu/gradprograms.
Welcome to The Book Show, a celebration of reading and writers. I'm Joe Donahue. Megan Mayhew Bergman, author of the acclaimed Birds of a Lesser Paradise, has a new story collection that explores the lives of unforgettable women in history titled Almost Famous Women. The characters in her stories are defined by their creative impulses, fierce independence, and sometimes reckless decisions. The women all struggle to distinguish themselves. Lord Byron's illegitimate daughter, Allegra, Oscar Wilde's wild niece, Dolly, Edna St. Vincent Millay's talented sister, Norma, James Joyce's daughter, Lucia. The stories are defined by their creative impulses, fierce independence, and sometimes reckless decisions. It's a great pleasure to welcome Megan Mayhew Bergman to The Book Show.
Thanks for having me.
What brought you down this road to explore these almost famous women?
Well, I'm sure you hear this from a lot of writers, but we're all pretty good at cultivating obsessions. I think this book, more than any I've done, represents 10 years of obsessions, 10 years of my reading life. Just for my general reading interest, and almost from an academic perspective, I spent a lot of time reading biographies about unusual women like Natalie Clifford Barney, who ran a salon in the Left Bank of Paris at the turn of the century, and I started finding women like Dolly Wilde, who was Oscar Wilde's niece, and Jo Carstairs, who was an ambulance driver in World War I, and learning about Lucia Joyce, James Joyce's daughter. And I would do the cocktail test. I would bring them up over dinner, over drinks, you know, to my literary friends and relatives, and no one had heard of them. So I thought, here's an opportunity. I think there's so little known about these women that your imagination already is brought into play anyway. And so I just gave myself permission to write the stories.
At what point do you want the actual life to end and for the fiction to begin?
It's a difficult question. And if I'm really honest with you, it's something I struggle with. It is complex because I am an academic and I do respect facts. What I wanted to do more than anything was portray the psychological landscape of some of these women, so thinking about risk-taking, because I feel that in a lot of movies and books about women from this era, they portray the women in a flashy, sparkling, flapper-esque dress with a long cigarette and a gin fizz, and I wanted to talk about actual risk-taking and sacrifice and living boldly. And whenever you get into the psychological landscape, it's an act of fiction anyway.
Is there ever a point where fact gets in the way of fiction in the sense of, oh boy, if that just hadn't happened, we could do this?
I tried to make everything plausible, reasonable, believable, and yet still retain that crackle of good fiction. So there were women who didn't make the collection or stories that I couldn't find my way into because they didn't have that necessary crackle.
And when you talk about that necessary crackle, it's one of those things that you know when you see, I assume.
You do. I had a fiction professor in my MFA program, David Gates, who gave this sage advice: you know you're pulling it off if you're pulling it off. And I also have, I'm friends with the writer Alan Garganis, and he gives this wonderful interview where he talks about every piece of fiction should all rock, sing, and surprise. And I think about that.
Yeah, and he is a great example of there being a joy in not only the writing, but the reading, that there is a joy, even though the subject matter may not be joyful, but there is a joy in the reading of it.
Absolutely. He has given my number one piece of writing advice that I took to heart. It actually changed my writing life. He said, you should try to install something strange and something funny on every page, and the reader will stay longer. And I think his idea there is, I think it's strange and beautiful, but the idea of creating texture for the reader, you know, it does give it that crackle and surprise factor. The reader should never be able to finish your sentence.
The name of the book is Almost Famous Women. It is a collection of stories, and I'm hoping you can share with us a short section from one of the stories.
Absolutely. This is a section from The Pretty Grown Together Children, and it's about Violet and Daisy Hilton, who were two conjoined twins that I was looking at a website called Roadside Americana. And I think we all know writers' internet search history is pretty sketchy business. But Roadside Americana listed, all the famous gourd museums and strange graves that you can find on road trips. And I found out about Daisy and Violet. They had been in show business in vaudeville, but were pretty much conned into a gig and then abandoned outside of Charlotte, North Carolina, which is near where I grew up. And so I became interested in them, and my way into a story is usually through empathy. So I started thinking a lot about what's it like to have two minds and one body. So this is an excerpt from The Pretty Grown Together Children. I was told our mother was disgusted when she tried to breastfeed us. Just a limp tangle of arms and legs, too many heads to keep happy, Miss Hadley said, lips everywhere, strange cries. Miss Hadley was our guardian. We lived with her in a ramshackle house that was part yellow, part white, an eyesore on the nice side of town. The magnolia trees were overgrown and scratched the windows. The screened-in porch was packed with magazines, rusted bikes, broken lamps, boxes of old clothes and library books. "Weren't for me, you'd be dead," Miss Hadley said. "I saved you." Like stacks of coupons and magazines, we were one of the things Miss Hadley collected, lined her nest with. Once, when you were toddlers, you got out the door naked and upset the neighborhood, she said. She liked to remind us, or maybe herself, of her generosity, her ability to tolerate. Carolina-born Miss Hadley looked like she was 100 years old. Her cheeks sank downward, she had a fleshy chin and a mouthful of bad teeth. "Daisy," she'd say, "I'm fixin' to get after you." And she would. She once threw a raw potato at my forehead when she found me rummaging in the pantry after dinner. Miss Hadley slapped my knees and arms with the fly swatter when I talked back. Sometimes she'd get Violet by accident. "She ain't do nothing to you," I'd say, "leave her be." "Don't sass me," she'd say, "you've got the awfulest mouth for a girl your age." When we were young, Violet and I had the thickest bangs you've ever seen, enormous bows in our hair. There were velvet ribbons around our waists, custom lace dresses, music lessons. We were almost pretty. We learned how to smile graciously, how to bask in the charity of the Christian women in the neighborhood. We learned to use the toilet at the same time. We helped each other with homework and chores. Miss Hadley kept a dirty house, scummy dishes in the sink. There was hair on the floor, toilets that didn't work, litters of rescued dogs that commanded the couch. Her stained glass windows were cracked. The front door was drafty. Entire rooms were filled with newspapers. Her husband was dead, if she'd ever really had one, and she had no children except for us. Looking back, we weren't her children at all. We were a business venture. We fired the shotgun at Beaufort's terrapin races, presented first-place ribbons at hog and collared festivals. We tap-danced with Bob Hope. We crowned Wilson's tobacco queens, opened for the bluegrass boys at various music halls. We knew high-stepping cloggers, competitive eaters, the local strongmen. We knew showmanship. I remember my line from the terrapin races. "And now, ladies and gentlemen, the tortoise race." Years later, when I woke up in the middle of the night in a hot flash, that line would come to me. We didn't know to be unhappy, Violet and I. We didn't know we were getting robbed blind. We didn't know all about the money we'd made for Miss Hadley. "I don't charge you rent," she said at the dinner table, "but I should charge for those hungry mouths." We believed ourselves to be in her debt. We were grateful, even. Miss Hadley's yard was overgrown with ivy, honeysuckle, and scuppernong vines. When we hated what she'd made for dinner, she was a terrible cook. We'd go out hunting scuppernongs and eat them fresh off the vine. We lived in what had been the maid's room, behind the kitchen. We shared a double bed, slept back to back. There was a poster of President Hoover tacked to the wall. Violet papered our drawers with sheet music and hid licorice in her underwear. Miss Hadley had lined the room in carpet samples. I kept a cracker tin full of movie stubs and magazines. Violet and I lay in bed at night talking about the latest sheet music or a boy who'd come with his parents to see us play at the music hall. We talked about lace socks, traveling to Spain, how we'd one day hear ourselves on the radio, learn to dance beautifully with a partner on each side. "I want to waltz," Violet said. "I want a new dress first," I said, "or to sing April in Paris on stage." "Teaching you to walk was some ugly business," Miss Hadley often said. "Dancing, I can only imagine. You girls need to work at sitting still, staying pretty. That's why you've learned to read music." Violet and I, we had thick skin. We slept with an army of rescued greyhounds, lithe and flea-bitten, in our bed at night. We fed them dinner rolls, put our fingers on their dull teeth, let them keep us warm. There were no secrets. Imagine, you could say nothing, do nothing, eat nothing, touch nothing, love nothing, without the other knowing.
Megan Mayhew Bergman reading a selection from her story collection, Almost Famous Women, the story The Pretty Grown Together Children, Almost Famous Women, published by Scribner. In just hearing you read that and how beautiful the prose is and getting into the mind of that woman and getting into the minds of these women, was it always a decision to say, first person is how I want to do this? I'm going to write in first person.
I really was challenged by that. A lot of these women, like Romaine Brooks or Jo Carstairs or Dolly Wilde even, are incredibly bold. A lot of them were independently wealthy or completely driven by faithful devotion to their art. And that's not always a voice that I can crack myself. And also I felt that if I wrote every story in first person, it would be as if the book was in all caps, as if the reader had opened the book and it was screaming at them. So a couple of the stories, I did choose to tell the story from a lover's point of view or a servant's point of view, thinking it's very revealing the way we see humans treat the other people in their lives. That's very revealing about character and gives the collection as a whole a little more texture, I believe.
Would you know right away, or would it take a crack at it before you learn that another voice was necessary for that story?
That's one of those questions that, you know, makes an artist feel like she's about to give a crazy talk. But it is that that sort of alchemy. It's that thing that happens at 3 a.m. when you're lying in bed. And I'm saying you're because I know I'm not the only one, fingers crossed. But, you know, the voices often come to me, the first sentence, the last sentence. And I'm sure it's just my subconscious working through a problem the same way we work through other problems. And it's sort of the solution that comes. So I usually know right away if it succeeds in first or third person.
I remember David McCullough telling me, and I've told the story before, but of how important it is, not just the writing of the book, but the thinking of the book. And that's exactly what you're describing, the actual thinking of it.
I couldn't agree with that more. I think every story, every essay, fiction or nonfiction, benefits from what I call think time, because it improves the quality of insight, and every piece should have that. And one of the reasons I think a lot of these stories succeed is that I was thinking about them for many years, nearly a decade, before I gave myself permission to write them.
This is a collection very much about choices, about women making very important choices to their lives. And as you say, there were women, there were stories that didn't make the cut earlier. But was it partially those choices that drew you to these particular women?
It is. And I think, you know, I'm a woman in my mid-30s, and as I was writing these stories across the last 5 years, I was thinking about building my own life and considering my own hard choices. And I'm really fascinated when we see a woman as the hero of her own story. I had this revelation when I was reading Beryl Markham's memoir, West with the Night, for the first time. And what's so unusual about that book is that we see a woman as the hero of her own story, and there's the absence of a central romantic storyline. It's just Beryl, and she's a talented pilot in, you know, rural Africa, and she is Africa's first certified female horse trainer. She's a woman with dreams and a very physical life, and when her marriage doesn't work out, she's living in a tent underneath a racetrack in Africa. And I was so fascinated by that because even in a contemporary context, her choices seemed bold and rare. And as the mother of two daughters, I thought, I really want to see more women portrayed that way in fiction. I really want to talk about risk-taking women.
When you think about it, just as the title indicates, Almost Famous Women, that these are women who are related in some way to the famous. Do you think there's a through line? Is there a commonality there that creates the situation by who they are and who they are indeed related to?
I'm so fascinated by the idea of fame. At the beginning of the book, I have a line from Ezra Pound's poem, "'Tis the white stag, fame were a hunting, bid the world's hounds come to horn." But I'm fascinated by fame as something that intoxicates us, that we orbit, that we're influenced by, that we may want, but also that we may be overshadowed by, in the case of Dolly Wilde or Allegra Byron or Lucia Joyce. Whatever it is, it certainly informs or can inform power dynamics and hierarchy. I was fascinated when I heard from a few readers that, you know, these women don't deserve to be famous. And I was interested in that because I don't think of fame as necessarily a noble end or something very progressive or something ideal. But I do love the qualifier almost famous women because it says something about valuation in society, and I'm intrigued by that.
And as you just indicated, it also, by saying that these women didn't deserve to be famous, it indicates that they were perhaps trying to attain that, which in many cases they were not.
Right. Some of them just wanted to paint like Romaine Brooks. I do think she wanted to be appreciated for her talents. She didn't paint the last 40 years of her life, but I think most important to her was just to live as an artist and to live authentically and as she wished. And that's a common theme throughout the book of women who knew it was dangerous to love the way they wanted to love or chase art or build a particular life because it was very difficult for women to do that, especially if we're talking 100 years ago. I think it's even difficult for some women to do that now.
In the stories that you chose to tell and the women that you chose to write about, did you find, and again, I'm going to ask you about commonalities, of a thread that went through them in their personality, a drive, a necessity of their spirit?
Yeah, I think they all share the common trait of being passionate. And as an adult, that's something I found I'm very attracted to as a character in a book or a character that I'm meeting in real life. I love people that have passion, that are driven to accomplish something or become an expert in something, or simply driven by wonder, you know, of finding out more about the world and about people. I love intellectual curiosity.
When it comes to the curiosity, because as you say, this is born out of your curiosity. So bring us through how you find out the truth of these women who are almost famous and little known.
Yeah, I think a lot about that, the truth. And is it something I captured? Is it something anybody can capture? I was teaching a memoir class at Bennington College when the idea for this collection really started to take hold in my life. And I would sit there with my students and we would debate truth. If we were to try and write straight facts, that's journalism in a way. But if we were to try and tell a story even about our last week's experiences, we would inevitably begin an act of fiction. Of course, we might know where we had been and at what time, but if we were to tell you how we were feeling or what the atmosphere was or to really create the psychological landscape, it really does become an act of fiction. And so it comes down to intent. And that was something I challenged myself on a lot. And I think many biographers might feel this way too, where you don't want to fall in love with your subject. You don't want to romanticize your subject. And I didn't want to undercut these women's choices by trying to paint them as victims. I really wanted them to be in charge of their own story, and they are flawed characters, and I wanted to let that live a little bit on the page.
In that letting it live a little bit, it can create a heartbreaking narrative.
It can. And, you know, one thing I struggled with after I'd written this book, I wondered, have I made cautionary tales here? You know, showing women that live boldly and take risks. A lot of them end up poor and lonely, but I think a lot of these women knew very well what the risks were and wanted to live authentically and chase their passions regardless.
How were you impacted? And this is probably an impossible question to answer, but when you look at the first collection, what did you learn from that experience and learn about your audience and the type of fiction that you wanted to write?
Yeah, I'm trying to give myself permission to evolve as a writer. I think my sensibilities have changed. I think anyone who reads and writes with great ardor and passion does change over time. And so I do think these collections are different. I do think they're representative of my concerns at the time as I was writing them. Birds of a Lesser Paradise I wrote when I first became a mother and first moved 12 hours away from the north, from the south to my home in Vermont, which was a really radical shift in lifestyle and selfhood. And then this collection I wrote when I was evaluating what it's like to become a woman. And when I think about my life as a writer, I think to Edna St. Vincent Millay's quote that whenever a person puts a book out into the world, they appear in front of their populace with their pants down, which is a way of talking about vulnerability. And it's something that anyone who wants to make art has to make peace with.
Do you always, when you're writing, feel vulnerable, or is there a confidence that has to be there as well to know that you can tell the story of that vulnerability?
I do feel more confident as a writer than when I wrote my first book, although I've heard many people say you never write as bravely as you do with your first book because you don't know the feeling of having to stand behind it, of weathering criticism and people saying weird things about you on the internet, which, you know, is an occupational hazard. And
sure.
It's, yeah.
And the opposite of that, of course, is a book reading where people who are coming know you, they've read you, and they like you, we assume, or they're not going to spend an hour and a half hearing more about you. So what is that experience in talking to readers who are active readers and are interested in what you're putting on the page?
I love that experience when people engage with my work seriously. And thinking about a question you just asked about writing safely and confidently versus dangerously, I think about this in terms of my writing and in any readings I give. My job is to entertain and never to waste a reader's time. So I try to give a gift, whether it's a gift of insight or letting the reader, leave their life for a little while and step into a new one, or insight, beauty in a sentence. And so I do try to give myself that litmus test, never waste a reader's time.
It's a journalistic necessity that I ask the question that is asked of all short story writers, which is, would you at some point write a novel, consider writing a novel, want to write a novel?
I am in the act of. I have one under contract with Scribner. They've been very good to me, and I'm grateful to them for that. It's a great house to belong to. But I am working on one, and it's interesting as a short story writer when I'm used to having a lot of control over my sentences and being able to reread a story literally hundreds of times. I have to let go a little bit to finish a novel draft. I can't start from the beginning and read it all the way through before I pick up and work on it every day. So I do want to exercise a lot of control, and I know I'll edit it to pieces, but it's a different act for me. It requires different work habits.
I've talked about this process with many writers, George Saunders and Lydia Davis and Richard Russo and Stephen King, that often their work, a novel, will come out of a short story that it just cannot be contained and it takes on that life of its own. Or also that there are writers who say that it can't be that way. It has to come very naturally as a separate form. Have you decided which you are yet?
I believe in both. There's a story in Almost Famous Women, the story about Jo Carstairs, the siege at Whale Cay, that is such an alternate life. I mean, it takes place on an island, and I think there's something really narratively powerful about an island because it has its own setting, its own highly specific pressures. It's a really pressurized environment. The tension can get ratcheted up very easily without escape. So I have to say, out of the stories in the collection, if I were to say any of them were begging me at 3 a.m. to make a novel out of them, that's the one.
Megan Mayhew Bergman's new story collection is Almost Famous Women. It is published by Scribner. Megan, what a delight. Thank you so much for being with us, and best of luck with the collection and the future work as well.
Thanks for having me.
A great pleasure. Thank you. Again, the name of the book is Almost Famous Women Stories. It is published by Scribner. We enjoy hearing from our listeners about our shows. You can email us at book@wamc.org. And you can listen again to this or find past book shows at wamc.org. Sarah LeDuc produces our program. Bookmark us for next week. And thanks for listening for The Book Show. I'm Joe Donahue.
I want to be like everyone else, so no one will point and stare. to walk down the street, not attracting attention. No notice, no mention, no hint of despair. A normal reaction, a standard response, the same as everyone wants. I want to be like everyone else, but richer and more acclaimed. Worshipped and celebrated, pampered and loved, to see those who've laughed feeling ashamed. A glorious, frantic, adoring response, the same as everyone wants. I'd go abroad, see all the sights, hear folks applaud.